There's no free lunch when it comes to investing. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast with Greg and Colin. Greg, it's good to say that you're back on the podcast.
It's nice to be back.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little 7 month hiatus, but it feels good.
Yeah. So how'd retirement work out for you?
Well, interesting. I think I need to spend more time with our guest today talking about retirement and some of the various things to watch out for, because the one thing I can say about retirement is it's not exactly what you expect. No, no matter what you expect. It's not what you expect.
Yeah, and we are very pleased to have a guest join us today, Carl Richards, who's been on the show before. Carl is a certified financial planner, author, the creator of The Behavior Gap, which is something that we've followed for many years, just a way to get the messaging out to clients with simple sketches. And he's got a new book called Your Money, and He calls it a conversation grenade. We're going to get into that. So I won't steal any more of the thunder from Carl, but Carl, thank you for joining us on the Free Lunch again. Pleasure having you here.
Of course, Colin. Thanks, Greg. And Greg, yeah, that's a super important topic, right? Like, it's super fascinating. Retirement. I mean, maybe we'll get into this, but retirement, I feel like going full gas for 60 years of your life and then golfing. It's not what humans were meant to do. So we can talk more about that, but it's no surprise.
And let me just add, if you don't golf, then you've really got a problem.
Yeah. And golf being the metaphor for like something other than work, you know? Yeah. So excited to talk about it.
You want to kick us off, Greg?
Well, sure. As Colin mentioned, you describe your new book as a conversation grenade. And so what kind of conversations are you hoping the book detonates?
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a great question. So if we were taught anything about money, we are often taught that it's a math problem, right? That it should fit into spreadsheets and calculators. And then you go to touch it in your life and the feelings show up. You know, like there's fear and greed, shame, you know, embarrassment, envy, you know, and you're relatively surprised by this idea. At least I always was. It's a little bit like you touch an electric fence that you didn't know was electric, right? You're expecting it to be math. And then suddenly you're like in a fight with your spouse or feeling some, you know, interesting feeling about what your parents used to say to you when you were little So I think the kind of conversations we need to have more of are those, like, conversations that make room for money to be a mirror, right? I don't want to overstate it, but more money's a portal into your soul. You know, like what do you care about? What do you value? Mm-hmm. What's important to you? Because when I ask people, like, I've done this little experiment in workshops and then keynotes all around the world, where I will just ask people, I'm going to draw something on the board. I draw it on my iPad, it shows up on the big screen. And I want you to pay attention to the first feeling you have, or the first thought you have and the first feeling. So two things, the first thought and the first feeling. And then I just draw a symbol of the currency. So if I'm in the States, I just draw the US dollar sign, right? And nobody says the first thought or feeling they have is medium of exchange or store of value. Like, they say things like anxiety, excitement, like they say feelings. And so I think that's why we have such a hard time with money, is because we are going into it expecting it to be a conversation about math that it turns out to be a conversation about feelings. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of conversations I'm hoping to have more of.
That's really cool. You know, we've been doing a lot of mind mapping with clients the last few months anyways, because the focus that we had, of course, was always around financial planning, which is important. But lots of times people look at these plans like it's just the roadmap of exactly how things will be. We're like, well, right. No, like the minute it's printed, it's probably not going to go that way. And things will change and things like that. So we've been focusing on mind mapping to try to understand people's interests, values, and that doesn't always equate to dollars, right?
Yeah, I think, like, again, Greg, back to your question, like, what kind of conversations? Like, here's one. Why? Why are you doing this in the first place? Why is your money invested the way it is? Why are you saving that way? Why are you spending that way? Like, what is it? So yeah, the values that sit underneath our use of capital and aligning that, aligning what you say is important to you to how you actually use your money. And to be honest, your money, time, energy, and attention, like four sources of capital. Like that's real planning. And that sort of integration and alignment never stops because it changes, and then like reality strikes, and then the world, and then the economy, and then, you know, your family. And so you're continually recalibrating sort of your alignment with your use of capital. That's the conversation, right? Like, why are you doing this in the first place? Cause so many of us have just inherited stories and goals. What is Stephen Covey's old phrase? Like the last thing you'd want to do is spend your whole life climbing a ladder only to find out it's leaning against the wrong wall.
Yeah.
And so many of us have done that. And you're like, it's not even the wrong wall. It's not your wall, right? It was your parents' wall. It was society's wall. It was what you saw on Instagram. So all of that's a mess, and it takes, and of course the financial plan itself is a really important guidepost, but it's constantly course correcting, right? So that's a really good point. The values that sit underneath the plan, purpose that sits underneath the plan.
Well, so from your experience then, like what is it that stops people from talking honestly about money? Like what's getting in the way here of having these conversations?
It's such a good question. There, look, I mean, to start with, we were never taught how to do it. And I think fundamentally it comes from what we talked about earlier, that we don't even know what we're talking about. Like we think we're talking about math. It quickly develops into something else. We're surprised by that. We've been given no skill. So I think that's the very base level is like, we just don't know what we're even talking about. Like we've given money a job it can't do, like, you know, make me feel like I have enough, help me feel safe, help me be happy. So like we've given money a job it can't do, and yet we expect it still to be about math, and we haven't really ever talked. So one reason that gets in the way is we don't even know what we're talking about. The second reason is we have no training. Most of our parents didn't teach us. Money, sex, politics, and religion, you just didn't talk about it. And I mean, I can't think of four more important things that I want my kids to be able to talk to me about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. And then on top of that, as soon as you do all of that layer, there's like this sense of comparison. There's some shame if I'm not as good, like if I think about the language we use around this, like, you know, what are you worth?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like what's your, like we might maybe use more sophisticated language. We might say like your net worth, but like what, oh, that he's worth. Like yeah. You're yeah. like yeah. fundamental. So like, we're like, wow, am I worth as much as you? Are you worth as much as me? And then we've got spending issues. And so I think that's why it's deeply emotional. It's hard to do. We don't have the training. It feels threatening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, traditionally it often feels threatening for men to have these conversations because very traditionally here, right? Like there's some hardwired, like if I'm not providing in a certain way, I am less than someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So you wrap all that in and you understand why, like, we need to start having different conversations, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, we receive a number of referrals all the time. And the question I get all the time is, what's your minimum? And the answer we've been giving is we don't really have like a dollar minimum. Our minimum is that you have to be a good person and you've got to want to do the work with us, right? And we'll figure the rest out later. We can't help everybody, but... Yeah, because I think that on the financial planning aspect, a question for you, Carl, is how can advisors help clients see money as something flowing through their lives instead of something separate or abstract?
Yeah, that's such a good question. The word flow is so interesting to me because I think money's natural state is in flow. It's like why we call it circulation and currency and cash flow. And we have built an entire industrial complex around the idea of damming it up, you know, storing it, putting it in reservoirs and barns. And so I think if we can help the humans that we call clients, these people that we love, understand that money in and of itself is just purely a means to an end. It's a tool to be used. You know, you'd never get upset or feel shame about the hammer. No. You know what I mean? If you needed to put a screw in a wall and you had a hammer, you wouldn't feel upset or ashamed about the hammer. You would just go get the screwdriver. So yeah. Understanding that money is just a tool, and we got to get better at understanding, like, is it a tool appropriate for the job that we're trying to do, right? There are jobs that money can do really well, and there are jobs that money can never, ever do. And if we can understand that, then we start to understand, like, money is just a tool flowing through our lives to be used. Some of that use is to store up for a future need. Some of that use is for experiences with today. And the tension of balancing that future versus today is the beautiful dance, right? Around getting clear and then unclear and then clear again and recalibrating. Like, it's just this never ending process of understanding, as money flows into my life and it flows out of my life, how can I use it in ways that it's best suited for, right? So I think the more we can help clients understand, and the more we can understand ourselves, to be honest, like all of us, you forget clients or planners, like all of us as humans, how can we understand and I think of designing little experiments. This is one of the things that I think we could all do better is, like, you know, Greg's going to retire. He needs $5 million in a sailboat. Well, it's it's pretty interesting, like, to design little experiments. Like, Greg, have you ever been on a sailboat? No, I haven't. But I saw it on Instagram. Like, that's what you do when you retire. I'm going to retire and I need to golf a lot. Well, do you enjoy golf? Like, can I just design? So here's one example. I have a friend who travels a lot for work. And he's always felt like he should be a car guy because he was a valet in Los Angeles when he was young. So he's always felt like he should love cars. And everybody tells him he should love cars. And he makes a lot of money, so he can afford any car he wants. Travels a lot for work. Every year or so, when he goes to the checkout at Hertz, he says, you know what? Give me the Porsche. It's an extra $200 for the day. And he says, but he doesn't even have to get it off the lot before he's like, okay, I admire this. It's really cool. The craftsmanship's amazing, but it just doesn't do it for me. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a $200 experiment versus a $120,000 mistake.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So running more of those, like, I think going to movies with my friends is something I value. Okay, we'll go, let go and pay attention. Did that use of money get a return? Right. Like, I think art is important to me. Okay, what's the smallest experiment you can run? Gosh, every time I see it, it makes me so happy. Oh, interesting. Maybe art is important to you. So, like, we just get better at using money as a tool and seeing if it produces the results we like. And where it produces the results, we want you to spend extravagantly to the degree you can afford it.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't produce the results, we want you to cut ruthlessly. So that's how I would think about that.
Seems to be, there seems to be kind of an overlap here with, you know, sort of man's search for meaning. Because because when you think about it, I mean, we all start, you know, our careers, you know, with, okay, well, we want to get a good job and we want lots of money. And of course, we always... The assumption is, well, lots of money is better than less money.
Yeah.
Because down the road, it'll give you more options. But what you're talking about is, well, what is it in your life that gives you meaning? And as you say, and how does money help you achieve that meaning? And it doesn't have to be deep meaning. It just, you know, as you say, it can be things that you enjoy or that bring you some amount of pleasure or happiness. But how do you make that transition? Because the the 26-year-old, you know, starting out in a first job is a very different person than the 55-year-old who's starting to think, okay, well, retirement or some change is seriously in my future here, and it's not a distant future, it's a near future. So how do you make that transition for, because convincing a 26-year-old in their first job that it's not the money as the goal, it's the lifestyle or whatever brings you meaning.
Yeah. That's a really good question. I think you just try to design. I think of them as not fail safe, but safe to fail experiments. So like with my kids that are in that age group in their 20s, early and late, all the way through early and late 20s, like how can I run a little like, oh, how did you enjoy that weekend? You know, like we talk a lot about value creation and value extraction with our kids in that age group and their friends who like to come hang out here at the house. Like sometimes the value you're extracting from an experience, like, okay, I've got an opportunity to work in the lab at the, we've got a daughter in med school. I've got an opportunity to work at the lab at the med school and it won't pay me much, but I could also work at the local sporting goods store for minimum wage over the summer. Well, okay, let's think about the value you would extract, the value you would extract from working in the lab. Well, maybe it's not the dollars, but maybe that value, oh, it's experience, it's connection, it's research, it's opportunity. Is that going to be more valuable or less valuable than the minimum wage you'd earn at the hardware store or the sporting goods store? Well, I don't know. I'm not making a value judgment here, but it's a good conversation to have. Well, maybe I could make more, maybe it would be more valuable to work in the lab, but I really want the experience of going to work. Well, then you're extracting a different set of value than the minimum wage there. So I think just thinking through like running little safe to fail experiments, like, gosh, oh, I really want to buy some cryptocurrency. You know, something a 20-year-old would say, oh, well, how could we design a safe to fail experiment there? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, what, why? Tell me more about it. Make a thesis for me. Hey, if you can convince me, I'll match you. You're $500, I'll match you $500 if you can convince me. Like, present to me, prove to me, like, great. Okay, well, the best thing that can happen is it goes to zero, right? Be safe to fail, but now you get to learn like, okay, well, what were the principles you invested there on there? How did that work? Oh, it turns out investing on a vibe may not work very well. You know, like the worst thing that can happen is it triples. Yeah. Now you have to talk them into understand. But so that's how I would think about that is how could we craft experiments at that age where we start to understand value and how can we could craft an experiment around like, oh, have you noticed that when you're 45, you may want more options? Oh, I wonder what would happen if you did something today that set up, like, could you put some option money away? Mm-hmm. You know, like, so I just, like, having conversations is how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Having conversations, which is what, right, like, the book, that's the goal, right? Like, it's 101 of these conversation grenades to sort of help people start those things.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, and you talk a lot about money and math, of course, but how do you balance embracing technology while preserving this emotional side of these money conversations?
Yeah, give me a little more insight into what you're pointing to here.
Well, I mean, right now what you brought, I guess the question came to mind because you're talking about crypto, right? Like we get a lot of questions about crypto. We get a lot of questions about AI. We get a lot of questions about changes. Yeah. Like the way that Greg and I, well, technically Greg retired, but the way that we've done it over the years is different than the way we do it today, right? Like when I started my career 25 years ago, it was all about picking the best stock and how do you do it? How do you source it, right? Now it's just way different technology focused on way different things. Like I don't think anybody can pick the best stock, for example. I don't think people should be embracing cryptocurrency. How will our jobs change with the advancements of generative AI? I'm not sure, you know? So just trying to understand that landscape.
Yeah, I think that actually is a question to me about how do you navigate uncertainty? Like how, and like change, like when the ground, and to your listeners, if you feel a little unmoored right now, a little bit like the ground is shifting beneath your feet, you're not alone. It does. I don't know if it's uncertain, more uncertain than the past, but it certainly feels that way. Like the perception certainly is at least there, maybe a combination of news and politics and AI and tech, like all of that mixed together. And so then the question becomes largely about, the way I think about this is preparing yourself to be, sometimes I call it harder to kill, but what I really mean by that is generally resilient rather than event-specific resilience. So like event-specific resilience would be, you know, I'm preparing specifically for a subprime mortgage crisis because do you remember 2008?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
We don't talk about 2008, Carl.
Yeah. Well, if you did, what you would do is you'd prepare specifically for something that's already happened and probably will not happen. In fact, I guarantee you it will not happen the same way it did in 2008 because they never do. And so general resilience is more like, hey, do we have a margin of safety here? Do we have an emergency fund? Is the amount we spend lower than what we bring in? Like, is our burn rate low? Then we layer on top of that. Okay, great. Given that, how do we want to invest the money? Well, it makes sense to invest money based on data, science, and evidence, not based on feelings and vibes. Mm-hmm. Well, why? Because we can show you over time, there's been lots of vibe investing forever, all the way back to tulip bulbs. Mm-hmm. And it's always produced suboptimal results. So why don't we be, so we sort of try to ground ourselves in the data and the science instead of the stories and the myths. And we build a plan that helps us be generally resilient. When uncertainty rises, we want to flee to simplicity. Like if uncertainty goes up, we want to do anything we can to make our lives simpler, right? So that would mean being more generally resilient. Like if I'm really uncertain about my job right now, I'm starting to think about, can I delay any decisions that would lock me into something? If I was thinking about buying a new car, can I just hit pause? Mm-hmm. You know, if I was thinking about buying a new, I'm just trying to make my life simpler. Build in more margin of safety because the uncertainty is higher than it has, at least it feels higher than it has been. Mm-hmm. So that, and then sometimes there's like, man, I feel really certain about this. I just signed a 10-year contract I might be able to shrink that margin of safety just a little bit if I feel really, so it's just this modulation. As things feel more uncertain, I want to be a little bit simpler, a little bit bigger margin of safety, more resilient.
Well, so speaking of that, I mean, how can advisors reframe that uncertainty for their clients is something, you know, that's kind of more dynamic and full of positive possibilities as opposed to only, you know, only something to fear.
Totally. I'm a big fan of uncertainty. Like I build it into my, like, I don't go into the high mountains or on river trips or climbing or skiing because I know what's going to happen. I go precisely because I know the best part of the day is going to be the thing I did not anticipate. I don't go, you know, your clients do not go to movies because they know the plot.
Right.
Exactly. You don't go to an art museum because you know what you're going to feel. And we call that surprise or drama or adventure, and we'll pay money for it. Right. And then there's other areas of our lives where we call it uncertainty and we get really scared because we don't like uncertainty. So I think the first step in reframing it is understanding it's actually reality. Like this, we had this myth that we knew what our lives were going to look like. And there might have been, you know, maybe 40, 50 years ago, white picket fence, job with a pension. There might have been a period of human history where it felt very, very predictable. But that's not the norm. It's mm-hmm. never been the norm. And so I think if we can first just get comfortable with, like, reality is uncertain. Like you said earlier, like, we know the moment one of your clients leaves the office, your plan is quote unquote wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite phrases is all models are wrong, some are useful.
Yeah.
Right. And so if we just start understanding, like, what we have is a strong opinion, let's hold it loosely, because what's going to happen as soon as we take a step, as soon as a day goes by, new information is going to show up. When we get that new information, we'll adjust the plan.
Yeah.
And so I think if we can frame, like, I sometimes think of it as like surfing uncertainty. Like if it's there anyway, it's reality. Like if you don't think it's reality, go back and read your journal. Go back and look. I want you to go back to January of 2020 And I just want you to tell me what your plans were for April or May. Like, what was your summer plan? You were going to go to the, you were going to go to the mountains or to the house on the lake in June because you have done that in your family for 25 years and you didn't go that year. And you didn't know that in February, 4 months before your trip was canceled. You did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's a dramatic example of the fact that life is uncertain. And if we can learn to be more generally resilient, more open to that, then we won't be surprised. I mean, it's still going to be surprising. It's still going to be a little scary, but we can feel in our bodies like, oh, I know what to do with this. I know what to do with this. Like, I'll wait. I'll get clear about where I am. I'll take a step. I'll see what new information shows up and I'll adjust.
For sure. I'm a planner by nature. You know, when we go on family holidays, it's not uncommon for me to create Excel spreadsheets of the times of the day and activities. It's a little over the top. I get it. My wife doesn't like it, but I like knowing what's ahead of us. But you have to have some humility in planning because you've got to adjust. You got to course correct, as you say, right? Like, so how does humility play a role in planning both for clients and advisors?
Yeah, it's a super good question because as soon as we accept reality that things change, that we don't know all the answers, that we don't, that does not, by the way, that does not diminish the need for a 30-year plan. Like what happens here is as adults, we've got to be able to accept two competing truths in at the same time. We've got to be able to hold these at the same time. The plan, the 30-year plan is incredibly important. We want to make it the best plan we possibly can. We've got the biggest computers. We've got, like, we really care. We're technically really smart. And we know it's going to be wrong. Like, we got to hold those things together in our minds. And clients have got to, we, as humans, we've all got to get better at this. Like, you can't expect a financial planner to map out the next 30 years of your life because they're just not going to. And I'm sorry that as an industry, we in the past, we might have led you to believe that we could, right? But what we're really going to do is draft this amazing plan. And then we're going to do something different than what everybody else does. I sometimes call it confirmation bias our way into it. Like, we're not going to run around looking for only the evidence that supports. We're going to actively look for disconfirming evidence. Like, that's the role of a planner has to be, I'm going to actively look for the ways in which I was wrong. Like, a financial planner has to learn to live in wrongness. Because for clients listening, look, the real job of a financial plan is to be a little less wrong tomorrow.
Yeah.
So we're going to narrow in. So your financial planner is going to try to be incredibly precisely correct today about the next 30 years, but they know the whole time their job is to be a little less wrong tomorrow. So we can narrow in on your intended goal over time. And so a good planner will come to you and say, hey, yeah, that's right. The assumption that we built into here about inflation was off. We used the 50-year assumption, so I can defend why we used that assumption, but it was wrong. And we've made this adjustment, and now your plan looks like this, and let's make some tweaks here and make some... That is a real financial planner.
Well, sure. Well, let's just talk about you and the book you've just written. So how do you hope the conversations that are sparked by this book are going to ripple out into the world, so to speak? I mean, how do you see this playing out, or how would you like it to play out?
Yeah, I mean, I have this crazy humble goal of starting a million conversations, right? A million meaningful conversations about money. And I just see the book and the sketches more generally, but the 101 sketches and 101 essays in the book, I just see them as a shortcut or a souvenir of the conversation. Like, everything about the way we design this book is meant to be handed to someone, right? And so that's my hope. Is I don't really care how many, it's not like, to me, it's not about copies of the book. It's about numbers of conversations. And so my hope is that, you know, this thing sits on your coffee table and your friends come by and they see it and they pick it up and they flip to a page and they read something and they say, what is that? What is that? What do you think about that? What does that mean? And then my hope is that that it gets handed to a client, and that evening the client's sitting around at the dinner table with their family having a conversation, and they think of the person who handed it to them, like, this conversation brought to you by, you know, that, like, I want to see these things compound, because we have no, it's not getting any better. You know, like, the anxiety around money is not getting any better, despite more apps, more tech, more TV, more financial pornography networks, more news radio. Like, it's not getting any better. In order for it to get better, we've got to have different conversations. We've got to have different conversations. And that's my hope. What the book will do is spread those conversations.
Right on.
That's aspirational and elegant. I love it. Yep.
Thank you.
Well, we've taken too much of your time. We're a few minutes over, but I could honestly talk to you for like the rest of the day if I had the chance. And
likewise.
You know, but I really appreciate you coming back and joining the Free Lunch Podcast again. And I will make my way to your house in Salt Lake City someday. I know that sounds creepy to anybody listening to this that didn't get the context before, but you maybe just share with the audience what I'm referring to. Give you a little plug here on your aspirations.
Yeah, we hold retreats here in Park City, Utah, and both at the house and at other venues here in Park City, but around money and meaning, and you know, hosting these conversations around a table, on a trail, and around a fire. And so, yeah, that's what you're referring to, and we'd be thrilled to have you. And Greg, it was a real honor to have you here today too. Thanks for what you do. You don't really need to be doing this. So the idea that you take time out of your busy days to do something like this and have these conversations is really valuable. And to be, I do lots of these, and it's incredibly evident to me who prepares and who doesn't. And so thank you for taking the time to ask such great questions.
Oh, thank you.
It was great to be back with you again.
Well, and just as we close out here, Carl, Greg and I started this podcast in COVID because it was, I think, April of 2020.
That's right.
And we were going in the office every day and we're like, what are we going to do with our time here? We hadn't planned for all of this free time. Let's do a podcast. That's how it started. Yeah.
Yeah, so. Amazing.
All right.
Well, thank you, guys.
Well, thanks again, Carl.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Till next time.
Yep. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, and exempt market dealer. Canvas Wealth is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy cannot be guaranteed and is subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals and do not represent the opinion of Q Wealth as a firm.